Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we are live today. Today's program being live means you can call us or email us questions. We'll answer directly on the air. The local number, 410-662-8780. Toll free, 866-661-9309. Or send us, if you're shy, the emails to foremanwolf, that's F-O-R-E-M-A-N-W-O-L-F, at WYPR.org. Morning, Cindy. How are you?
Good. Beautiful day.
It's a beautiful day when you know you're going to be drinking great Italian wine in the studio.
It's very exciting that Lavinia is here, going to be here with us.
So, although we have a lineup of some questions already on wine and a lot to talk about with Italian wine, we have built up some food questions. So, if you don't mind, I've got a bunch of listeners' food questions I'm going to shoot at you. Okay. The first is from Elizabeth. We love shad roe and cook it several times each season. Living on the Eastern Shore, we have a good supply. I always have the same problem. The violent spattering is the eggs burst. Even with the spatter guard, one has to lift it to turn the roe once. Two nights ago, I got a bad burn from the spatter. I cook it on quite low heat and a bit of butter. Any suggestions?
The only thing I can tell you with that is maybe cook it in corn oil instead of the butter. Butter has, or clarifier butter, at least without the water content in the butter. Once it's clarified, you'll have a little bit less water action with the fat. But there really is no way around it. It's just a hard, it's a dangerous thing to work with. I remember when we did it in culinary school, and people that were not familiar, my parents are from York, Pennsylvania, so I'm very familiar with it. And kids that didn't know anything about it were shocked at how it reacts in the pan. It's tough to cook. So a lid and just be careful. That's the answer.
All right. Another question from an email address. There's no first name. Send a name if you want us to say your name on the air. Could you explain again how to make turkey leg confit? I heard you at Thanksgiving, and I don't think you have to just make it for Thanksgiving. But could you talk about a little bit again how to make it? I really enjoyed it, but I don't think I had the butter and the length of time right, something like that. It sounds like it maybe didn't come out.
But. Okay. I would hit it with salt, pepper, and a little bit of probably fresh rosemary or dried thyme, either one, and let it cure for 24 hours. And then put it into the fat. So you're going to immerse it in fat. So it needs to be completely covered. And I would take the skin off the legs. There's no reason to leave the skin on. And that butter can also have a little bit of salt and pepper in it, maybe a couple of bay leaves, a couple of peppercorns. And you want to cook it at about 180 degrees, and it will take several hours. So you want it on very, very low heat. You would not want any bubbling to be occurring in the fat. You know, when it wants to be very gentle, I would put a thermometer in there just to make sure, into the fat, just to make sure that the temperature of your oven is right. But yeah, around 180 to 200 degrees. And it's going to take a long time. But once it's tender and falling off the bone, it's done.
You think probably like a 4 hour.
Actually, two and a half to three.
Yeah.
It's not that long. It always depends on how big your turkey legs are.
If you have huge
turkey legs.
When you say cure the leg, you're talking about rubbing it down.
Just with a little bit of seasoning.
Yeah.
It just helps with the flavor.
And
leave
that in the pan in the fridge for how long?
24 hours or even less.
Okay.
You could even do it for an hour, just as long as it gets some sort of seasoning into it. And
but
then,
acid and...
No, not at all. Not at all. Just salt, a cure. It's just a very simple cure. Salt and pepper and... That's all you need.
Okay. If you want to call in with any questions, we're going to get right into the wine program. But we literally have a stack of listener questions about food I wanted to start the program with.
Mm-hmm.
Please give us a call, 410-662-8780. And the next one is about fiddlehead ferns. Do you like fiddlehead ferns?
I'm not fond of fiddleheads, and you know that very well. I almost never cook with them, but all of our other chefs do. So you can always get them at other restaurants, and I know you like them.
I like fiddleheads.
You can answer the question.
So someone said they were stuck in the rain for the entire hour on traffic last week, and were listening and kept wishing they could call, but didn't have their phone, and wanted to know. They have all these fiddleheads in their yard.
Mm-hmm.
They must live in the woods.
That's great.
So are they all edible? If they're actually fiddleheads, I believe that they are. But
yeah, I mean, we're not scientists, so...
I'm not going to go by and certify.
Right.
I've not heard of
right.
poisonous fiddleheads.
No, I think you're probably okay, but you might want to look it up on the internet. It's a great resource. But yes, fiddleheads are almost nutty in flavor. They're unusual to cook, and you want to cook them gently. And there's a lot of different things you can do with them.
Okay, a question from Nancy in Annapolis, who I'm betting is from the Pacific Northwest, saying, Today's show, your guest said Maryland crabs are better because they have more fat because of living in cold water. Well, what about Dungeness crab from the Northwest? I guess I could Google the water temps. But you have thoughts about Dungeness crab?
Dungeness crab, much bigger crab than our blue crabs. I've never worked with them because I've never worked out west. I've always lived on the East Coast, so I have always worked with blue crabs. But, so I really don't have too much advice there. And I certainly don't know I'm not knowledgeable about the water temperature. But I would assume that you're cooking them pretty well the same way we would any crab. You know, you want them to be cooked until they're tender. And I'm sure you're going to do better with them this summer. I'm sure they'll be more available this summer.
Okay, and I've got one last one for you from Jessamine, it looks like. I love to have people over for dinner to sit outside in the glorious weather, so on and so forth. Looking for a cut of meat that is less expensive than flank steak. I see London broil go on sale a lot. Does that turn out tender enough with a certain grilling technique? I have a gas grill. Also, boneless sirloin steak or boneless New York strip are sometimes lesser-priced ones, sometimes in value pack. I guess the question is about being economical and grilling beef. What do you suggest?
Well, you know, it's funny he would ask about flank steak. Flank steak used to be an inexpensive cut of meat, and it's become more in demand, and beef prices have gone up. So flank steak is actually much more expensive than it used to be. So you're probably looking for a cut that's there's not much less expensive than flank steak, frankly. I mean, you're almost going to have to look at something that's on sale, and even a ground beef, which would be probably one of the less expensive things you can work with, but probably is not what he's looking for.
Yeah, I think I will admit that I always think that we're treating ourselves, and we treat ourselves to giant cuts of things, and maybe the real trick is how is the rest of the meal composed, and finding something you really like, cooking a reasonable quantity of it, serving it beautifully, and leaving it at that, and cutting your quantity down and controlling your budget that way.
Yes.
But, but balancing out the rest of the menu.
Definitely. That'll work.
And so, all right. So let's get into Italian wine a little bit.
Absolutely. So what grape varietals are we talking about?
Well, the most popular grape varietals in the U.S. are not the ones that you always see in Italy. I think any discussion of Italian wine, you need to talk about regionality. And there are 26 different regions of Italy. And you have things from the Alps and the Dolomites that are, super bright and light and cool climate. Mm-hmm. And you have things from way down south all the way into, to Sicily or where Lavinia, our guest for the next two segments, is from Puglia, that super hot growing zones. So you have grapes that are adapted to all of these different zones. That's one thing to realize, that the regionality of the cooking and the wine is extremely diverse. The second thing to realize is that the grapes, a lot of them have adapted to the places for a very, very long time. Most of the indigenous varietals, and if you think about when did the popular grapes in California come there, they came there with settlers maybe 100 years ago, sometimes a little bit longer. They're vines that have good age now. It's funny because most of the oldest grapes in California, almost all are Primitivo grapes, known as Zinfandel in the U.S., planted in Sonoma County, mostly by Italian immigrants, an awful lot of them coming from Puglia. It's a funny little coincidence.
That is interesting.
But most of the grapes that Cabernet Sauvignon, Chardonnay, Merlot, Pinot Noir, that you see in the States that are popular, Sauvignon Blanc, are French grapes, and they are inherently, the grape traveled up the Italian peninsula, from the Mediterranean and into France. And even older grapes, as far as how long something's been planted in France, say Syrah, the grape on the Hermitage Hill, has been there 1,000 years or so. There are grapes that you see, Nurello Mascalese, for example, on Mount Etna, that a grape that's been planted there for 3,400 years. So there's a different scope of time, and grapevines are very, very adaptive, and they tend to change an awful lot based on climate and season and conditions and how they're treated. So you have all of these different zones, and you have all of these different grapes that have been adapting for a long time to the different zones. So the first thing I think of with Italian wine is diversity. And the second thing I think of is flexibility. And the third thing, and the most exciting thing to me, is how useful they are on the table. Because there's so many different kinds of cooking because of all the different zones of Italy. and things have adapted to the taste of the place as well as, you know, for the table, the taste of the place as well as all of the different styles of cooking, the different wealth of different regions, the different traditions, the different history of commerce in different regions. You have a crazy range of flavors and balance points and qualities that the different grapes have.
It's such a beautiful, the cooking is so amazing, and you talk about the relationship between the wine and the food and how ancient both of those things are, and it is just such an important part of the culinary history of the world, and it has affected, you know, Caterina de' Medici, what, you know, came to Paris and married the king's son and ended up becoming the queen or the ruler, and she had such an effect on cooking.
She brought the first great cooks to France.
And that's what a lot of people don't even realize, Italian food was a huge influence on French cooking. And was that, yes, and that was 1400s, is that?
1500s.
Yeah, late 1500s, all right. So, you know, I mean, it's an interesting influence on French
cooking and on the
grape varietals.
There's often a purity, the traditional cooking in so many zones, it's about 1, 2, 3 products in their purest form, carefully, thoughtfully, you know, seasoned, prepared on a plate, and finding the grape or the grapes, the wine that's going to set that off is one. I think one of the most entertaining things about going to Italy in different zones and going into Enoteca, and Enoteca is not just a place where you can go and buy wine like in a wine shop, and it's not just a place necessarily to go for a meal. But what you often find is people eating, drinking, talking, discussing different virtues of different things, trying to share some grower that they just found, and wine being woven into the, you know, wine and the table being woven into the quality of life, sort of constant discussion. That speaks to, I think, some of that history. Your first question I didn't answer at all, which is what grapes are important. I would say that the grapes that we know really are the wines that we know that, for the most part in the States, just having restaurants where or shops where people walk in looking for Italian wine, we mostly know famous things from the center or the north of Italy. We know Barolo and Barbaresco. I always think the B's, Barolo, Barbaresco, and Brunello, which the wines are not remotely the same. Barolo and Barbaresco are two different zones of the Lange in Piemonte in the northwest, and the grape is Nebbiolo. And a lot of people would say that is maybe arguably the most important grape in some ways for complexity and for ageability in Italy. In the center of Italy, Brunello is Brunello di Montalcino, another robust red wine like Barolo and Barbaresco. And that's something that, you know, that has a lot of power. Sangiovese is the grape there. When we come back, we're going to have with us Lavinia Cassano and be taking your questions at Foreman Wolf on Food and Wine. ¶¶